Waking Up Is Not Enough, Flourishing in the Human Space, a podcast by Polly Young Eisendraff and Michael Berger. When you peek into the cosmic unity of existence and feel the love and inspiration of awakening, what happens next? Whether it's through meditation, spiritual practice, near-death experience, ingesting a mind-altering substance, or being born again, you don't get a map for improving your messy life. In this podcast, Polly Young Eisendraff and Michael Berger draw on expertise in science, psychology, adult development, psychedelics, NDEs, dreams, and Buddhist practice in conversations about compassion, resilience, responsibility, kindness, and development after awakening. You will learn how to chart a new path for flourishing in the human space, in which waking up is important, but not enough, and growing up is never finished. Co-hosts Polly Young Eisendraff and Michael Berger bring different kinds of expertise. Polly is an author, psychologist, Jungian analyst, longtime Zen practitioner, couple therapist, and founder of Dialogue Therapy and Real Dialogue. Michael Berger is an entrepreneur, an expert in psychedelics, a spiritual practitioner of Jewishness, a skeptic, a Real Dialogue specialist, and a filmmaker who is known for his documentary, Improbable Collapse, The Demolition of Our Republic. Polly and Mike will engage with each other and invite a wide array of guests who are accomplished scientists and seekers whose work lies beyond the hegemony of materialism.
In this episode, Polly and Mike talk with Bill Waldron, who is professor of Buddhist studies at Middlebury College, where he teaches Tibetan and Indian Buddhism. Bill has just published a new book, which is an important book on early Buddhism, called Making Sense of Mind Only, Why Yogacara Buddhism Matters. In this incredible conversation, Mike and Polly and Bill give a precise account of how to think about non-conceptual wisdom. That is, the wisdom that comes through experience and is not easily conceptualized. There's a lot of talk these days about non-dual practices and how to make sense of the connection of the self and the world, or the subject and object, or the perceiver and the perceived. And in this conversation, the three of us get into a view of early Buddhism that fits with contemporary cognitive science, also with real dialogue, and with a deeper understanding of developmental psychology and certain aspects of contemporary physics, which are essentially aligned with the sense that the subject and object are not separated in our perceptions as human beings. I can't recommend this conversation too highly. In many ways, I feel that it's a follow-up for all three of us to the conversations that we've had with Don Hoffman, and also to all of our concerns about waking up in a non-dual world.
A lot of our listeners don't know the words Mahayana or Majjhimika. And, you know, some people consider these terms to be kind of foreign. And I know you teach Buddhist studies, and so they just roll off your tongue. But if we could just start by defining Mahayana, and then, you know, tell us about Majjhimika just a little bit. But Mahayana is the more important one.
Okay, so the Buddha was born in 5th century BC India, or what is the subcontinent. His teachings developed and were distributed, transmitted around the subcontinent for quite a few centuries. And then roughly around the beginning of the Common Era, there was a new form of Buddhism started to develop. And this was called Mahayana Buddhism. And Mahayana means the great vehicle. And what characterized Mahayana in terms of what great means is that the purpose of awakening is not for one's own liberation, but rather in order to achieve the wisdom and compassion and to work for the liberation and the welfare of all beings. And this is the figure of the Bodhisattva. So the Bodhisattva is very strongly connected with these Mahayana traditions.
You know, again, this fits very well with what we've been talking about, you know, what happens after awakening, like, you know, waking up is not enough. But, you know, why were these early folks, why weren't they satisfied with just the early forms? Like, why did they move on from the focus on the Buddha to the focus on the Bodhisattva? There must have been some good reason to change forms and practices.
But, you know, this is pretty hotly debated in scholarship about the development of Buddhism, Mahayana Buddhism. In general, one might say that they found the orientation towards individual liberation to be too limiting. Therefore, they developed this idea about becoming liberated in order to help others.
Yes.
And I think one of the reasons for that is that it precludes the possibility, the temptation, we might say, wanting to become liberated just for one's own well-being, and right, therefore a subtle form of sort of self-centeredness can arise. That's kind of a psychological explanation that it's hard to attest to from a historical point of view.
So let me just say that I'm going to bring Mike in here for just a second, because one of our big conversations ongoing has been about taking psychedelics to wake up. And then sometimes becoming self-centered about one's specialness or how you know everybody else should do it. There are many things that are happening right now in what can be called the psychedelic renaissance about waking up. And you know, it occurred to me that some of the movement in early Buddhism away from waking up for your individual liberation to waking up in order to help all beings, that some of those problems are occurring now. So I just wanted Mike to jump in for a second and see if he wanted to say anything or ask anything before we'll move on to Yogacara per se, but this is sort of setting the stage.
I'm curious about the focus you mentioned with moving away from just individuals' liberation or self-liberation to assisting other sentient beings on their path to liberation. Is there an intersubjective component to that? That focus away from self, maybe? The interconnectedness of consciousness as a projection or a manifestation of a unified field of consciousness in Yogacara?
Oh, in Yogacara? This is different than the
Beginning
of Mahayana.
So in the Mahayana context, then, is there an intersubjective component to this, the Bodhisattva concept in any way? That, in other words, for any one individual being to find liberation, it requires the liberation of all sentient beings to be part of that experience.
You know, several centuries after Mahayana started developing, people would articulate it more clearly like that, somewhat similar to that. We do not see that at the very beginning in some of the rationales. Buddhism in India and the subcontinent, after the time of the Buddha, had no central institution, no central authority, and it was widely diffused in the subcontinent. So there's a lot of developments that kind of show up in the historical record at certain times, long before there's a lot of real systematic thinking about it. So this is why talking about motivation is hard. I'm from a historical point of view, right? A lot of the most articulate formulations are usually a couple of centuries after the stuff shows up, because it's very fecund kind of religious environment.
I thought Mike would really want to note it from the point of view of psychedelic side of things, that there was a movement in early Buddhism away from individual awakening for one's own well-being towards awakening for all beings. And as you said, it's developed over time, and there are many schools, and there was no central office, you know, for adjudicating the issues of Buddhism. There's no Rome, there's no Mecca in Buddhism, really. Phenomenologically, this is an important shift. And I think just as people think about awakening, And it's one reason why I like Yogacara, because Yogacara does outline some things that are practical. You know, I mean, there's a framework for all this. There's a lot of stuff in it that is not practical for lots of people. But here's one practical thing that, you know, if you're practicing to wake up just for your own well-being, there have been some people who would question that, you know, like large numbers of people would question that. And there's been a development of Buddhist practices that at least address the, I don't know what to call it, the ambiguity of the issue of waking up, whether you're waking up for yourself or you're waking up to wake up, you know, the interconnected beings that are all over in samsara, space-time, or whatever. I don't want to go too far into this because I'm sure it's its own sort of ball of wax, but is there any more that you want to say about the Mahayana, the movement from early Buddhism, Theravadan Buddhism, to Mahayana Buddhism before we go to Yogacara?
It's a radical transformation of virtually every dimension of the Buddhist tradition. New ideas about what a Buddha is, including the three Buddha bodies. And this is, I think, kind of reflects an awareness or sensitivity to the question that Michael was just asking about what is it, in a sense, that kind of connects us all. The development of the Bodhisattva path and the development of new doctrines, particularly the idea of emptiness as a kind of flip side, one might say, of dependent arising. So it's just a total transformation. But particularly this idea about the three bodies of the Buddha, and not just the Buddha, but of reality per se, Dharmakaya, the body of all dharmas, of all qualities, is said to pervade the entire universe, which means it's the ultimate nature of what we all are, but we just don't realize it. And so from that point of view, the notion of separation, of there being actual individual, independent beings that are ultimately independent, is seen to be a function of ignorance and self-grasping. And that raises a whole lot of other issues about karma, et cetera. But fundamentally, individuality is seen to be a construct that brings about suffering.
Yes, yes. And so that, you know, puts a kind of framework around people seeking waking up just for themselves. And I don't want to say I'm critical of that. It's just that I do believe that in Buddhist teachings and, you know, to some extent now in many things that are arising, that sense of interconnectedness is fundamental. And so the idea of a separate self is problematic or the result of not understanding the fundamentals, not grasping the fundamentals. I would like you also to say something about Majjhimika, because you introduced the term, and it's also a significant term in regard to forms of Buddhism that develop after the original forms.
We talk about two schools of Mahayana, Yogacara and Madhyamaka. This formulation and these names actually came into common use centuries after classical, the beginning of these traditions. So after classical Yogacara, it's about two centuries later that Yogacara and Madhyamaka start to be characterized as two different so-called schools. But the Madhyamaka school looks to the figure of Nagarjuna, who was a Buddhist monk in South India, who sort of formulated in philosophical ways the teaching of emptiness, which shows up in the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, some of the main Mahayana sutras. And so this is a school that kind of developed the notions that not just persons have no selfhood, but all phenomena whatsoever have no unchanging essence. This is the meaning of this term emptiness. And so what came to be called the Madhyamaka school ended up developing a very rigorous sort of philosophical analyses for why there could be no such thing as unchanging essences for any phenomenon. They see themselves in some ways as the arbiter of orthodox Buddhist doctrine, that if we think that anything has an unchanging essence, that we're contravening the words of the Buddha. And so this sets up a whole lot of discussions and debates with lots of other schools who have different ways of formulating things. But so it's a really important part of the Mahayana tradition.
So this, I mean, you could, there's an interesting way to say no thingness instead of nothingness that can help people understand the concept of emptiness, because Even emptiness is not a great translation, I think, in English. I wonder if you could take a moment, again, before we go to Yogacara, just to do this one thing that you've emphasized before, that part of our suffering comes about when we take a particular sense experience, like seeing something or feeling something or hearing something, and we turn it into an object, like we heard this thing, you know, we heard a song, and the song is this song. And even though, you know, I heard it, like this weekend, we were playing a song called Send in the Clowns. And there were people in the group when we were closing our eyes and just listening it. Several people heard it as Send in the Clouds. And it became a totally different song for them with different interpretations. And then they wanted to know, what was the real song? What is the real song? And I was trying to emphasize that there is no real song. You know, even though there was Judy Collins singing a song called originally Send in the Clowns that was written by Stephen Sondheim, none of those people were there in the room. So the songs that we heard were a wide variety of different kinds of songs. And people were relating emotionally to what they heard. And afterwards, you know, after we heard it once, I asked people just to speak for themselves and say what they heard and what it brought to mind. It was crazy, the degree of difference, you know? And so again, because there is no song, there are these experiences. And to me, this is what backs up to the idea of emptiness, you know, that the thingness is our mistake.
That's not really different than mainstream Buddhism, really. This is, you find this in the teachings of the Buddha and other forms of Buddhism as well. What the notion of emptiness is trying to really impress on people is that all phenomena, what we might think of irreducible phenomenon, whether that's material, physical, psychological, spiritual, linguistic, conceptual, whatever, it's all without some unchanging, irreducible essence, something, no matter what it is. And so there's this tendency, very pronounced tendency in this stream of Mahayana to just say, it's not like this. It's not the way we imagine. It's not what we think. All of our maps of reality are just maps of reality, including Buddhist ones. And they're nothing to grasp onto, including Buddhist maps. It's what you said times 10.
Yes, all the way down.
I heard you say in listening to the song with the group, there is no song. I would just push back on that a little bit to rephrase it. We can only speak about our subjective perception of hearing the song and how it arises in our awareness. We can't make any statement about the song. Whatever it is, we're experiencing. We can only speak to our subjective experience of the song and can't speak to the intention of the creator of the song, what their intention was. Even if we ask them, we may get a different answer at different periods in their life, in their career, etc. So it's not that there isn't a song. It's only that I can't see anything meaningful about the song.
Well,
may be related in a sense to the concept of this emptiness. I can reflect what's going on in my subjective awareness, but if I understand this concept of emptiness, it's about not grasping to whatever arises in my subjective awareness. Kind of like the metaphor of a still lake reflects the sky, but it doesn't grasp it. It doesn't interpret it. It is a reflection of it.
So I think that's accurate. But again, in a sense, Majjhimika, as Bill was pointing out, is that way very, 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 very deeply. You know, it's like there is nothing and nothing and nothing, but your perception of it is also momentary. It arises and passes away. By the time you speak about it, you can't really remember the perception you had. And so many times we are fighting about, well, it was a cloud. No, it was a clown. And that I have to say that in the group, there was some anxiety about the song once people started talking about the clouds. And there were people in the group that were younger who had never heard the song. And then there were people that grew up with their parents listening to it who had a very negative sense of it. And some people hated clowns. And the whole thing was about clowns. So, I mean, to me, it was a very good illustration of what arises when we're supposedly having this experience together, You know, we were sitting there with our eyes closed, played this thing, this whatever it was, three times. And then people spoke about what they experienced. So, you know, I think that when there's a radical kind of dependent arising, which again, Bill will have to define, but, you know, the things emerge and pass away. That is the essence, in a sense, of this emptiness. It's not like things don't count or everything is just nothing. That's not it at all. I wanted you just to formulate then the Majjhimika school and or Majjhimika, and maybe even say what Majjhimika means, because I usually pronounce it Majjhimika, and then to Yogacara.
Okay, so Madhya means middle. So Madhyamaka means sort of the middle-ist and the middle way school. Madhyamika is somebody who is an adherent or associated with the Madhyamaka school. So it refers to people. It's just that Sanskrit sort of makes new different words. That's very interesting. The thing about the anxiety about this song is people want to have some certainty there to tie things down. This is a form of attachment and clinging. And I think that one could say that this is mostly what we do all the time, is we're trying to fix meaning, because impermanence and multiple points of view creates a lot of anxiety for everybody. So this is why we imagine, and that certainly the Buddhists would say this, why we imagine there's a real there, rather than sort of this unfindable sets of experiences that we're all having individually and together. And so this is what we do. We create words, we reify things, reify concepts, reify experiences. And then we can say something that we think is meaningful, like what the song means or doesn't mean, etc. And then we can get antagonistic about our differences. You know, and the thrust of the Buddhists would be like, don't grasp onto these things. Pay attention to what people are experiencing, but they're not to be grasped onto. They're to help us understand ourselves and each other, of course.
I know that as I've, you know, learned from you over time, some of the focus of the concerns that gave rise to Yogacara as a school and so on had to do with the original focus in early Buddhism, as well as in Majjhimika, on momentariness, you know, that things do arise and pass away. And so if everything arises and passes away, well, what's the problem? You know, how do we get stuck? Why do we get so stuck in our identities and in our arguments, and then, you know, even go to war, kill each other over these beliefs, which could be, you know, like the difference between a cloud and a clown. And one person hears it as the cloud and another one hears it as the clown, and they go on and on about what that is. So I wonder if you could talk about that issue, about momentariness and, you know, the need for something else. Other than, or in addition to, because early Buddhism could sound like behaviorism. I mean, originally, there were, you know, when the translations started coming to the West, I know in psychology, there were people who said, oh, that sounds like behaviorism. We just change our behavior and we're, you know, then we're okay. Everything can change.
Well, yeah, everything can change. But what the Buddhists want to emphasize, and again, this was even before Mahayana, well before Mahayana, is karma, is actions. Actions have consequences. And some of the consequences of our actions is to build up structures. You know, we can think about it like in behaviorism, conditioning of various kinds, our neurological structures, our cognitive structures, not to mention the rest of our bodies, et cetera. And these are consequences in part of our intentional behavior. And it's these identification with the structures that have been built up that brings about suffering, because we imagine that they are simply given. We imagine that they are permanent. We imagine that they are ours. It's trying to grasp onto what is ungraspable that causes a lot of suffering. And so recognizing that things are impermanent is a good remedy to us trying to grasp onto things as permanent. And this is why it causes suffering. Without the grasping and without the identification, the fact that things are changing all the time is kind of neither here nor there. It's just how things are.
You know, you mentioned body And so you mentioned our body. So, you know, often, again, psychologically, people believe that they are their bodies. I mean, Freud even talks about the body ego, that the ego really is the sense of the body, you know, that I am in here. Uh-huh. This is my body and I need to protect it and I need to make it feel safe. And I need to also do the right things for it, et cetera, et cetera. Particularly in the West, I think at this particular moment, people are preoccupied with diets, exercise, what they eat and drink, maybe more than ever in my life, people are preoccupied with that. Even though I thought 10 years ago it was plenty, but now it's even more down to the little iterations of the types of things and what they mean, taking, you know, if you take this into your body, if you have this diet or that diet. So this kind of reification of the body, you know, reification meaning simply making it into a thing. And then it becomes a thing that you have to take care of, protect, make safe, et cetera. I think many people find it very hard to believe that Buddhism is saying somehow or teaching that the body is not a thing. And so I wonder if you could talk about that or talk about Yogacara in relation to the way that, you haven't yet laid out exactly what Yogacara adds to the mix, because we've talked about Majjhimagga, but not Yogacara. So just I want to focus on the self and the body and that kind of thing, if you can, coming from karma also.
Okay, well, to say that the body is not a thing is just another expression, in a sense, of emptiness. The body is a term that we use in order to refer to sets of processes that interact over time. And this is just a really catch-all way that we can talk about emptiness. It's empty of unchanging essence because it is full of these interacting processes over time. So, of course, the body's not a thing. It's sets of processes that are constantly taking in stuff, processing it, getting rid of it. And this is true in any type of thing we want to put a name onto. So it's, it's impermanent and it's not ours. I mean, it's, half of my body, what do we say? All of our cells change every 7 years. And I mean, I don't know if that's accurate from a biological point of view, but I've certainly read that many times.
It's accurate for some organs, particularly like the pancreas. I used to know how many hours it took for it to change. It changes within a few days, all the cells are different in the pancreas. Yeah. Wow. And then in some organs, there is also a fast changing of cells. But you're correct to say that certainly by 7 years, all the cells have changed. And so also, if we look at pictures of ourselves, you know, that we call ourselves from earlier times, you know, we're almost unrecognizable. We hold on to the idea, oh, that's me. That was me when I was two. That was me when I was 14. And that narrative is very, very strong for people, very strong. And some people, you know, make their lives around nostalgia, really, looking back at earlier pictures and images and thoughts about me. So it's very strong, this sense that somehow we're connected to the body and particularly not to the brain. You know, people have an idea that the brain produces consciousness. And so the brain is an especially important organ. You know, to say that the brain doesn't really exist. Now, we've been talking to Don Hoffman, who says it really doesn't exist. And, you know, if you're not thinking about it, it doesn't exist. But then we were talking to Jill Bolte Taylor, who's talking about the cells of the brain and how the cells are in competition with each other, et cetera.
To say that the body is not a thing is not to say that it doesn't exist.
Right.
Right. It's very easy to confuse those things. And I think mostly a lot of Buddhist rhetoric, if I may say so, a lot of Buddhist rhetoric is confusing.
Yes.
Because if we are fooled by the appearance of permanence, then we have to look deeply into impermanence. And when we look deeply into impermanence, we see that there are no separate things which exist, which is a very kind of counterintuitive way of talking. But once we see that separate things don't exist independently, then we recognize instead that things, what we think of as things, are sets of processes of interaction. So rather than talking about what exists, it's, the Buddhists would say, it's more useful to talk about things that occur and processes that occur in interaction. And that avoids this whole discussion about what exists or doesn't exist, which is always confusing. The Buddhists confuse themselves too, if I may say so. And so it's not just us. And one of the rationales for the Yogacara school to develop, you know, starting around the third century, was that it was easy to misinterpret the term, the idea of emptiness, that things don't have unchanging essence, and to think that what that means is that things don't exist. And so the Yogacarans are concerned with rectifying that misinterpretation. And what they're saying is emptiness is a remedy. The concept of emptiness, the insight of emptiness, is a remedy towards our reification. It is not a declaration about what exists or doesn't exist. That means to say it's about modes of knowing, not modes of being. It's epistemology, not ontology. But I teach this stuff all the time. It's almost impossible for people to understand that the first several times around, because we're so used to thinking about things exist or don't exist. And if it's not a thing, then it must not exist. And the Buddhists just say, let's get rid of existence and non-existence as two extremes and talk about how things dependently arise, how they come about dependent on conditions. And this is what the Buddha said. And this is what everybody kind of reiterates as soon as they sort of get off from that center and veer towards existence or veer towards non-existence. People will come along and say, we need the middle path here about things occurring. And this is one of the major points of the Yogacara school when it first appeared, kind of at least historically, in the third century of the Common Era.
So that was an argument that the Yogacarans made to clarify, like you say, epistemologically, this issue surrounding emptiness.
This is like the one of the main rationales of this idea of the three turnings of the wheel of Dharma. This shows up in the first Yogacara Sutra, or discourse of the said to be the words of the Buddha, the Samdhi Nirmochana Sutra, it's called. And that is the Buddha taught early Buddhism, especially about karma, which is extremely important, about cause and effect and us getting caught in these wheels. And then he taught the early Mahayana discourses and the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. And this is where the concept of emptiness gets discussed to a great length. And we have Nagarjuna's philosophical commentary on that. But the third turning of the wheel is what the Yogacarans would say themselves. They're saying emptiness is not a statement about what is. It is a remedy for us imagining and reifying that things have this sort of permanent essence. And so when we say it doesn't have a permanent essence, it's not saying things don't exist. It's saying they don't have that unchanging essence. That needs to be clarified. And so what the early Yogacarans are saying is, we just want to clarify what emptiness means here. It's a remedy for our own tendencies to reify. It's not an ontological statement about what exists. So this discussion is really, really important for the kind of the development of Buddhist thinking at that time.
Part of what I'm hearing is this is a challenge with language. How do you speak about these things? Because in the structure of our thought is related to the structure of our language, which implies there's a subject and an object. So it feeds into the reification. So what I'm wondering is, part of what I see Polly and I doing is kind of bringing together a new, or pointing out that there's a new metaphysics arising in social and physical sciences, where even quantum physicists are letting go of these old models that we're looking at something out there. And it's a form, a reformulation of idealism that really seems to me to dovetail with what we're talking about here with emptiness, especially, that I can only speak about my own subjective experience, but it is not in any way making a comment or a statement about any external reality, such as in emptiness, the term that these objects don't contain some indwelling essence. It's what arises in the moment within my subjective awareness, but it doesn't necessarily mean that what I'm witnessing, I can't say anything about what I'm witnessing. I can only speak to how it appears to my awareness. It seems to require a change in how I speak I have to include, or I choose to include, my subjective perspective in discussing what arises in my subjective awareness. So in other words, I'm not speaking about something out there. I'm talking about maybe an inner correlation to whatever is arising. And I can only make statements about my subjective experience here. So maybe this is also connected to a problem with language. And that I'm wondering, like, I'm beginning to see this new model emerge in philosophy, a new metaphysics that seems to correlate very well with what you're discussing in Yogacara.
I want to add one thing before we move into this. I can see how complex this is going to be. I would like to get rid of the idea of idealism. I know that it gets kind of kicked around in regard to Yogacara. Also, Don Hoffman's theory is called conscious realism.
Yeah.
We could get into, and I don't mind talking about idealism and realism and, you know, and pragmatics and so on. I know it's a little bit philosophical, but I would like to talk about only what's useful in it, you know, if we can sort of glean that. But there is a problem with the subject and object. There's that problem with the split that all humans really develop as a result of their own development when they're young and the self-conscious emotions coming on board, et cetera. But then there's this other side. I just wanted to put this into the mix, which is what people call life and death. People tend to separate life and death, even though experientially they know they're never separated. But the idea is now I'm alive and then I will die. And that motivates a lot of intentional actions in people. Like, I need to protect myself from, you know, eating too much fat, or I need to protect myself from, you know, people need to protect themselves from so many obscure things now, but really with the idea that so I can stay alive, because, you know, there's such an important thing to my staying alive. And, you know, when I'm teaching, I always say life and death are intersecting. First time I had a baby, I almost died. The baby almost died. It was a very good illustration that, you know, getting born also can mean dying really in that moment. So, you know, birth and death completely connected. Also, subject and object are connected in a way that we don't, through our common sense, perceive. So, you know, I would like to hear from Bill on, you know, these things of subject, object, common sense, idealism in the framework of Yogacara. And Bill's book, of course, is called Making Sense of Mind Only. Yes. Which sounds like idealism. It sounds like, and this is why Yogacara Buddhism actually matters is the subtitle, but it does sound like idealism. I don't believe it is, but I think lots of listeners don't even know what is idealism anyway. What are you guys talking about?
Well, this is true. And this is it'll take a couple of minutes to sort of lay out all these basic issues. One of the things that happened in the interpretation of these two schools of Mahayana Buddhism is the teachings of emptiness appear to be directed towards the mode of existence of things. That it means it appears to be directed towards our naive realism, that we're predisposed to think that things are real, kind of the way that they appear. And when we make statements that when you analyze them, they don't appear that way. And the reason that they appear one way or the other is because of the cognitive schemas that we operate under. So if there is no real external world, the thing that is most real and that explains how we experience things is our internal world, our subjectivity. And so that's a shift from what we might call realism to an orientation on subjectivity that is typically described as idealism. And that is the shift that later Indian Buddhist and people in the Tibetan, Indo-Tibetan kind of Buddhist world say the Yogacarans are doing, that it's idealism. They're saying that mind only exists. They're interpreting it as in terms of existing, which I think is a fundamental mistake, that mind only exists. There's been, that's the mainstream in the Indo-Tibetan modes of interpretation, which have been very influential for Tibetans, and Tibetans have been very influential in bringing Mahayana Buddhism to the West. So this is what most people have heard of Yogacara, this term mind only. There's a stream of scholars and other people in the Buddhist world that say this is not really what Yogacara is saying at all. And my book is squarely within that camp. that there's a middle way between realism and idealism. And that middle way is the Buddha's teachings on dependent arising, right from the beginning, that the Yogacarans are constantly referring back to the Buddha's early teachings, and especially dependent arising of awareness. And the dependent arising of it means that when something impinges on a faculty in a living body, we have an experience, right? We are aware of that. But that awareness is not purely subjective. It is a function of interaction in a body, in an environment, in a social and physical environment. And so the blur, the lines between what is subjective and objective is constantly being questioned, because we never can really get outside of an environment in order to have a pure kind of subjectivity. And this notion that we have a pure subjectivity is like an essence of consciousness rather than an essence of matter. And the notion of dependent arising, the analysis that things are this constant interaction over time, precludes us thinking that there's an absolute subjectivity or an absolute objectivity right from the beginning. And this is what the Yogacarans are deeply interested in looking at. Why do the world appear the way that it does? It's not a unilateral projection from the point of view of subjectivity, because we are embodied beings and we are in an environment. So it is always a function of interaction, but we don't see it that way. We have a tendency to reify objects. And then if we unreify objects, we say that's just an appearance. Then there's another tendency to reify subjects. And so in Yogacara meditation, almost invariably, there's a critique of apparent independent objects. And they say, well, if there's not an independent objective world, it appears to be an independent subjective world, then there's the critique of that, because subjectivity is itself always a function of processes and interaction. And so mind only is not an ontological statement about what exists or did not exist. It is a critique of our tendencies to reify objects. It is just an appearance. It's just a perception. It's just a mode of awareness. It's not really truly objective, and nor is it truly objective. And then once one gets on with recognizing that, this whole tool, a remedy called mind only, is also jettisoned, because it's not a statement about reality. It's a tool to get over our naive realism. And I'm sorry, maybe that's too long, but this is the argument against why it should not be interpreted as idealism.
Enjoyed this episode of Waking Up Is Not Enough, Flourishing in the Human Space? Don't forget to hit like, subscribe, and tap the notification bell so you never miss an episode of insightful discussions and explorations into the human psyche. Share this episode with friends and family to spread the journey of self-awareness and critical thinking. Together, let's challenge the norms, embrace empathy, and flourish in our unique paths. Your support means the world to us and our growing community. Share your comments in the thoughts below. We love hearing from you.
The center will be offering a new foundational training in dialogue therapy at the Trapp Family Lodge in Stowe, Vermont. The new sessions are June 27th through 30th, then August 22nd through the 25th, October 31st through November 3rd. Please look at either my website or the Real Dialogue website. Click on to Foundational Training with Polly and have a look at the schedule. We will also be offering free trainings upcoming in various locations in Vermont, where we will be teaching the skill of real dialogue. So please join us, become a part of our community, and let us know that you enjoy what we're doing, and please contribute. We love to hear from you. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Please take a moment right now to go to realdialogue.com and join our membership community. For a short time, we're offering annual and lifetime membership in the Real Dialogue community at a very limited cost. There you have access to countless hours of teachings, interviews, conversations with Polly, Mike, and prominent scientists, sages, and seekers who share your interests in waking up and flourishing. Again, go to realdialogue.com. Join in a live conversation with Polly and Mike through your membership. The second Tuesday of each month, we have an AMA that we do together. As always, we really look forward to meeting you and to hearing your perspective. Please like and share the podcast with friends and family. If you know of people who you think would benefit from this conversation and would like to take part in our monthly AMAs, consider sharing this with family and friends and consider giving them the gift of membership in our community. This podcast was produced and edited by Chris Coltrane and is part of the Center for Real Dialogue. It is available on all major podcast channels for free. Thank you for listening.